Peter and Mark for giving me the opportunity to be here. So I'm just going to talk about stuff that's sort of old, but I think might be so interesting to people, especially if it's just a tutorial. The FAST multipole method has been mentioned several times, and it's a matrix structure. And of course, when they first mentioned the word FAST multipole method, or the way of multiplying these matrices, constructing these matrices quickly and multiplying them into a vector array. So of course, once you construct a matrix in some representation, there are always cases where you want to apply the inverse of the matrix rather than some vector. And this was also known very early, but now this, I've been in touch with the solicitor as a graduate student, so here I'll try to summarize from my point of view what the state is and how these things can be done efficiently and what are the open problems. So in my work, there's a lot of collaborative work with Ming, who is also a fellow graduate student of mine with me at Yale, and Patrick de Wolder, who's a professor of electrical engineering at the Netherlands. And so he, Professor de Wolder, gave a lot of these ideas were simultaneously discovered in electrical engineering and systems theory. And they had this fabulous way of looking at it when the graph is particularly simple using ideas from complex analysis. So many of those ideas we borrowed and put back into the FMM ideas and tried to see whether they would lead us somewhere. So here's that. Okay. So here's just an overview of what I will talk about. I'm going to skip how FMM matrices are constructed in the first place.
Excuse me? What does FMM stand for?
FAST multipole method. It was an idea invented by Greengard and Rocklin. And it actually can be traced back to early work of Rocklin in the 80s. When he first made his observation that there's a certain structure in these matrices. So these matrices certain matrices have this property that if you look inside them, that there are many sublocks which have low rank, and that these sublocks will actually finally cover the whole matrix. And since large sublocks have low rank, you could exploit this to speed up conventional matrix algebra routines like, you know, every factorization, QR factorization, of course, matrix multiplication or matrix vector multiplication, all of these things can be speeded up. So, of course, the question is, if you have a very large n by n matrix and all the entries are full and you want to find this low rank, you have to sort of go through all the entries and compute the ranks of these subblocks. You have to determine which are the subblocks you want to look at, and then you have to find low rank representations of these things. And obviously, these things are not trivial to do. Brute force search would be, you know, defeat the whole point because you want to gain multipliers quickly, and actually n squared flops in the worst case. So, of course, there's a lot of work in the last 20 years by Vladimir and his students and colleagues on how to find these for certain classes of matrices, and now they're doing even more work, and I think we'll hear about them when those special structures are not present and you have to do something clever like randomized algorithms. So here I'm going to assume that somebody's going to give us the FMM structure first. But I will talk about giving a purely algebraic presentation of the problem. You really need to know linear algebra to understand this stuff. There's only one part where I use analysis, and that I probably will not reach. That's the last point, so that's the only thing I need to get. Okay. So I start off by giving a purely matrix representation of FMM matrices, and I think this is useful because many people learn about FMM by reading Vladimir's paper, which straight away dives into how to compute the representation without telling you what the representation is. So here I'll just give a purely algebraic specifically on the representation, but make it much clearer in our minds what we're talking about. Then I'll actually present the recursions for multiplying the matrix into a vector, and that's the recursions of the FMM recursions. Then we will show that these recursions are actually linear recursions, and they can be given a single flow graph representation. And then once we look at these two, you can look at either of them independently. It's very clear that since these are linear recursions, these recursions can be themselves thought of as a set of equations. And then once you realize these are sparse equations, because these recursions are fast, so they're only very short recursions, then you have a huge sum of sparse equations representing the FMM. And therefore, you can just call any sparse matrix solver to solve those equations, and you can invert the FMM rapidly. So that's the summary of how the FMM can be rapidly inverted. And all of these ideas essentially present, at least to my mind, in Vladimir's early work. All of this was essentially known to him. Maybe he did not write them down explicitly. So constructing fast stable solvers for FMM matrices is quite easy in this sense if you want up to a certain complexity, which I'll talk about soon. But for many applications, the speed you get by these techniques is not good enough, and the question then arises whether we can go faster than this. and we call those super fast solvers. This really gets stuck in many places, all kinds of conjectures by all kinds of people, but how we can proceed further. But even though the conjectures have been verified to be true numerically, it's still very unsatisfying because we don't understand why exactly these structures hold. And I will talk a little bit about this if I get some time. Okay. So, just to repeat, so this is the word FMM was first written in this paper by Greengard and Rocklin on fast summation for certain physics problems. But the basic idea was that if you look at many matrices that have low numerical rank in the submatrices, and that these submatrices ultimately cover the whole matrix. That's key. And they show that in many cases you can actually compute these low ranks without forming the matrix. But there's a little bit more than just low rank, but they show that all that can be computed. And then they showed, and then this part is very easy. Once you get that part, then you can show that you can multiply these matrices into vectors very quickly. And then they showed by a more complicated scheme than what I outlined, but nevertheless the ideas are the same, that you can apply the inverse of this matrix to a vector also rapidly. And finally, they showed that the complexity of this operation will depend on this. They showed that we use this technique, this sparse matrix technique that I was talking about, and the solver will run in the power 1 plus d over 2 flops, assuming that the matrix came from a potential kernel, where d is the number of spatial dimensions they're talking about. So if d is equal to 1, then it's a linear time algorithm. If d is equal to 2, it's still very fast, it's 1.5, it's very usable. But if d is equal to 3, it becomes m squared, which is faster than n cubed, but it's not very practical either because constants in FEM get tremendously big right now. Anyway, you know, 10 years from now, computers could be much faster than even these algorithms in 3D could potentially be so of interest. But what we would like to do ultimately is knock this off completely independent of D. But there are a couple of blocks to that for sure. These estimates essentially are assuming that the inverse is non-oscillatory. So essentially we're assuming that there's some kind of partial definiteness involved. Maybe some kind of diagonal dominance is involved. But as soon as you take a shift, again, computing eigenfunction of Laplacians, you try to shift deep in to get a good, much higher frequency eigenfunction, make it become indefinite. You'll see oscillations in the inverse, and the low rank structures in the inverse will break down, and these kind of estimates will become the bottleneck. You know, you can't go faster than this after that. So whether you can in those kind of oscillatory cases is completely unknown. I mean, not just for these kind of class of methods. Actually, it turns out that sparse matrices are just a special case of FMM. So all these estimates hold also for sparse matrices automatically. Therefore, even if you went with a finite element method and use an iterative method, you will still run into these blocks somehow. Okay, so these are, it's not, I don't know of any conjectures even in this case.
What is meant by covert and what is meant by numerical?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. So numerical rank, it just means that you must set a tolerance and all the singular values smaller than the tolerance you're allowed to set to 0. Okay, so now, so let me begin by showing some pictures of these matrices so that we get an idea of what they look like. Once you see the pictures, everything else sort of becomes much simpler to think about. Actually, these pictures were there in Vladimir's student's thesis, at least. I don't know if they appear in any of his papers, at least, but they're there. I knew of them in 1989, so they're not my inventions or anything like that. Okay, so suppose, let's take a simple case. Let's take the points xi to be on, say, interval 0 to 1, and the entities of the matrix are given by log of the distance between xi and xj. And you arrange the points linearly in the line, and you look at the matrix. This is the picture of the whole matrix. Then this matrix has this nice property that if you go very far from the diagonal, then the points x sub I and x sub j are well separated, and the log becomes smooth. And since the log function is very smooth, the entities in the matrix look almost like each other as you move around. And this smoothness causes the matrix to take on a very low numerical rank. Okay, so this is the first observation that you have to follow, that if the entities in the matrix are smooth, rank is going to be, numerical rank is going to be low. Okay, and you can prove this rigorously, but that should be intuitively obvious that's the case. As you take these submatrices close and close to the diagonal, they're coming to the logarithmic singularity over here. The function is changing much more rapidly, therefore the entities of the matrix are changing much more rapidly, and therefore you should expect that the matrix is becoming, getting higher and higher rank. And as soon as you touch the diagonal, we pretty much assume it is full rank, though it may not be. So these black dots indicate that these blocks which are touching the diagonal, we assume has no further structure which we can exploit in Gaussian dimension. So So we're going to assume that they're just dense matrices. And all the low rank is in these things. Now, so that's the first observation, that if you partition like this, you can make sure that each of these blocks has a constant numerical rank p if you fix the threshold of tolerance that you're willing to tolerate, of approximation you're willing to tolerate. Okay, now, of course, one could at this point just say, oh, then now the easy to proceed, I can just compute, you know, the SPDs of each of these blocks, make them low rank, and then I can get a fast mid spectrum multiply in a very blindingly obvious way. That'll be fine under so-called tree codes, but that kind of a structure is not at all friendly to Gauss elimination. So if you try to Gauss elimination on this matrix, and you just try to use the fact that these are low rank, you'll find quickly that you run out of any kind of speed-up setup. Okay, so this way of just using low rank is also called H matrices and was invented by Hartbusch too. But I wanted to say that it's almost completely incompatible with Gauss elimination, so I will not talk about such structures, such weaker structures in this. Okay, so now what happens if we, unfortunately, the structure of this matrix is dependent upon some outside knowledge. So I'll just show some more complex structures to motivate why these things become more difficult in higher dimensions. So here I take the points to be in the circle, and I take the same logarithmic kernel. So now as the points go out and come back to each other, you'll find that these two corner points that the logarithm is blowing up again. So again, you must subdivide the matrices here to get the constant rank property. Notice that if you look at the backbone, the spine, where you have only the dense pieces, then you're getting the classical finite element of finite different discretizations of 1D, one-dimensional PD on the corresponding manifold. Okay, so if you had a PD over there, two-point boundary problem with PW, you'd get something like this. And if you didn't have it that way, then you'll get something like this. Something like this, or like this. Okay? Now, in two special dimensions, I spent a lot of time drawing this graph, so I showed it in every talk. So in two special dimensions, things start getting really out of hand, and you can see we're going to have trouble. So now, same kernel, but now the points are distributed on the plane. Again, you have to order them in a very nice way. There's no way to make sure that they're ordering, because you have to lay the points out linearly along the rows, rows and along the columns, but there's no way to guarantee that two points are nearby here are also close by in the plane. There's no such good ordering.
So what did you do? Did you use a zigzag algorithm?
No, this was a nested dissection algorithm, the one which Vladimir always uses.
Okay.
So we just used it, and whatever, technically I used no separators in this one. So the separator, when I cut the points in half, I made sure there's nothing on the line.
Okay.
It's known that it's not completely optimal. So, but Vladimir never uses separators, we didn't use separators too. It makes the picture a little bit obvious to see. The color scheme is supposed to show how the recursive subdivision goes on. For example, a green square will always get subdivided in this box again. And a red square will always subdivide these four boxes again according to this color scheme and so on. Okay, so it's a very messy structure if you look at it from a purely matrix point of view. If you look at the graph version of this, it's much more elegant and much more easy to follow. And all FMM papers written using graph representations because of this. In higher dimension, the matrices stop being very informative. But for a minute, just sit back, just think about this. So all of these blocks which are here have same rank p. That's the idea in FMM. We always make sure that the numerical rank is p, and this would be the splitting in that case. Now, assuming that p is zero, we just throw away assume that every block which is not filled in is just zero, so it just goes away. Then you will be only left with the colored blocks which are still left, and that colored block would correspond to finite different discretization, say, of the Laplacian on a square, using a 5-point stencil. Be the same thing. So that is why I said that sparse matrices are just a special case of FMM matrix. So whatever we say here, complexity-wise, also applies to sparse and vice versa. Okay, and actually the connection between sparse dense and sparse of FMM matrix was even deeper than this. We will show later on that an FMM matrix can be lifted back up into a sparse matrix, which has the same structure as the one you started with. But now all these p rank blocks will get thrown away and be replaced by actually zero blocks. The matrix will be bigger after that. Okay, and that technique was known already to sparse matrix analysis, but it never quite extended it to as generally as they could. It was considered a hack doing that. Okay, so this is what the matrices will look like. So how do we represent them? Okay, so this is the key, because if you could go for very simple representations, for example, like what I said, if you could just say, we know this block is now rank p, you could just find its rank p factorization. We throw away the part which we don't want, and we could just keep this representation. And we There are people who write codes like this. They call tree codes, and they're okay for multiplication. They're not the fastest, but they're okay, and they're very easy to write the codes. So people like these kind of codes. But such representations will not help you at all when you try to do Gaussian elimination on this matrix. Okay, so something more complicated is needed. And the more complicated thing is like this. So rather than computing the low rank factorization of this little block over here, what we have to do now is to look at the whole row which contains this block just to find this column basis U. Okay, we can't just look at this block alone. That won't work inside Gaussian elimination if we did that kind of representation. So if we look at this whole block, but we get to throw away some blocks. We get to throw away any block which is smaller than the width we are looking at, than the height of the row we are looking at. So if we're looking at a row of this height, anything smaller than that I throw out. Anything bigger, suppose it was intersecting this big block, I still have to keep it inside. Okay? So I take this whole row matrix over here, this whole row, and I compute its row base, its column basis, and that is the U I'm going to use to represent this little block over here. Okay, so this U not only is the column basis for this block, it's also the column basis for all of these columns put together. Okay, but the V is not computed at this stage, nor is the B. Okay, so to compute the V, which is the row basis for this block, I look at the entire column containing that block and throw away all blocks which are smaller than that. So all these guys get thrown away. Okay? So I take this big, all these rows, stack them up, and find a row basis for them, and I use that as a row basis for this little block inside. Okay, so this extra step, which is what makes it messy, is taken. Okay? So once I have the column basis and the row basis for this block, I can find the matrix P, which has this insert in between, obviously, and that is called the expansion coefficient. Okay, so every block now here will have B's, which represent the expansion coefficient in some column and row basis. And the column and row basis are always picked such that they go all the way out and all the way this way. The reason for this is each in itself, because when we do Gaussian elimination, we either manipulate whole columns or whole rows. And we have to do this, I mean, there's no choice. So we have to, if we're going to do this efficiently, then we must have a sparse representation for the whole block row, not just for a piece of inside it. Okay, so this is the key idea of the FMM thing. The next thing is that we want to further compress these representations. So right now, I was computing a basis for this representation for this block over here. Now let's say I want to compute a basis for this smaller block. In the windows, I will use this window, this column over here. But notice that when I try to find the U for this, I'm recomputing a basis for the top half of this bigger block. So this U, which is a column basis for this thing, is also a column basis for the top half of the previous U. So in other words, if I have this guy, I don't need to store the top part of this. It's recoverable by some other operator R over here. Okay, same way for the bottom part of this U. So this U was the basis for this bigger block. If I'm computing the column basis for this block over here, I'll use this big window over there, take all its columns, find a column basis U, R, and that will also be a column basis for the bottom part of this U, and so I can represent it by U times the matrix giving me this part over here. So rather than storing this big mess over here, I can store these two guys and these two guys over here. Okay, so we don't need to store the column and row basis at the coarser levels, we really need to store the column and row basis at the finer levels. To assemble the column and row basis at the coarser level, we use these operators over here. These are called translation operators in the FMM literature. Because they were originally used where the operator would actually translate the Taylor series expansions and the multiple expansions. Okay, so, but algebraically, these are just these matrices over there. So we don't have to know how that thing came from us and why this word translation is used. Okay, see, the same thing we do for the rows. We have a V over here, there are two smaller V's, so this big V can be written in terms of this V, the row V's at the final level through these translation operators, W. Okay, so we don't have to store this because it can be obtained from the V's at the lower level and the W's at the lower level. Okay, next, so maybe I'll show some, at this stage, I just, to relieve the tedium of this thing, I'll just show some experiments where we try to use the FMM to accelerate a sparse matrix solver. So remember, sparse matrix is a special case of FMM matrix, so we can, in principle, could use this. The PD we looked at was just this standard positive and elliptic PD over there. and we use a standard 5-point stencil discretization, fine difference discretization of the speed in a standard way. And we pick the coefficients p and q in these four different cases. So first we took p and q to be 1, so that's just a Laplacian. Next we took p and q to be piecewise constant, which huge jumps in between them. Then we took p and q to be this function, which is oscillatory and almost touches zero in many places. And then finally, in the discretized version, we just took p and q to be positive random numbers uniformly distributed between 0 and 1. Okay, so the last one doesn't come from this. It comes after you discretize it. Okay, so the idea was to check how much these the low rank structure that we were expecting would depend upon the coefficients p and q. Right? So hopefully all this part is what is traditionally covered by elliptic PDE theory. This one would fall outside that case. In every case, we found that the structure of the where did the FMM arise? Right? So I'll just tell you that, and I'll tell you why those three cases were looked at. So here's an example of the grid and how I order the points. This just illustrates where the FMM structure comes in. So let's say that we're doing nested dissection ordering. We cut down this using one interface over here. So all these points ordered first, then these points, and then these points. Okay, so that's just the grid. So first, all the x variables, then all these variables, which are called y, and then all these variables on these grid points, which are called z. So since it's a finite difference discretization using a 5-point stencil, if you write out the sparse matrix, it will look like this, like a block arrowhead matrix. So these variables only talk to these variables, and these are only talk to that, those variables. So therefore, if you look at x, it only talks to z. If you look at y, it only talks to z, and then these by symmetric. Okay, so at some point in Gaussian elimination, you will eliminate all the x variables, all the y variables will be left only with the z variables to solve for. And those z variables will solve and satisfy an equation where the coefficient matrix is given by this expression S over here. That's called the Schur complement of this block with respect to the rest of the matrix. Okay? So the typical argument used in the H-matrix literature is that since S inverse can be viewed as the restriction of the Green's function to the interface over here, okay, so it's called the Poincaré-Steklov operator, which is known to have nice regularity properties, then S itself must look like an integral operator, and therefore it must have an FMM structure. In particular, it must have something like a one-dimensional FMM structure. Okay, you notice that we started off with a 2D problem, but the fill-in, so this thing which occurs over here is actually a bottleneck in sparse matrix calculations. It is S, it's filled in, it's an N by N matrix, so if there's an N by N grid and this is an N by N matrix, it's filled in, and you have to typically default to using ordinary Gaussian information and making it an N cubed solver. That's how the estimates are made by nested dissection. So if you want to speed up ordinary sparse solvers, you must tell us how to speed up the inversion of this S. So the conjecture is that S will have this FMM structure. So if you could form the FMM structure of S without forming S, then you could speed up Gaussian elimination, the sparse matrix Gaussian elimination. Okay, so there's lots of details. How do you form the FMM structure of this expression without actually forming S itself? Because notice we don't have AX as inverse, nor do we have this inverse. So that's obviously some long calculation, and I'm not going to go into the details over here, but it can be done. And we did it, and we checked how much the code would speed up. And what we found was that our code was twice as fast if we used all the structures in all of these four cases compared to the traditional solver. Okay, so traditional solvers for two-dimensional elliptic PDEs, like for 5-point stencils, traditional sparse matrix solvers for these positive definite problems are extremely fast. Okay, they've been tuned to death. There's no point for anybody trying to beat them. So the fact that our code, this written by us, was twice as fast was very surprising. And what was even more surprising was that the FMM structure of that Schur complement does not seem to depend upon the smoothness of P and Q itself. It can be just random numbers for those things. Okay, so they're extremely rough functions. Okay, there's no notion of smoothness at all. It's point-wise random. And the FMM structure is held. So this part, there is no understanding at all of why it holds like that.
So I have a question. I mean, if you assume that P and Q satisfy the standard uniform ellipticity condition, you know that you have a priori great estimates on the Green's function for it. So maybe that's what you're seeing there.
Could be.
Even the gradient has this beautiful structure in the completely random case.
I'll be testing this thing.
Yeah, I'd love to talk with you about that.
There are some estimates about trying to using what is known in the continuous case to try to say something about the matrix in discrete case. But paper by Bibendorf, I think.
Yeah, there's some relation basically to the Haar wavelet expansion of P's and Q's.
I see.
These somehow control the. We'll do it offline.
What's your reference when you say standard direct dispersal? Are you comparing it to nested dissection or something?
Yeah, this was nested dissection with one. So the solver that we used, I believe, was the one inside MATLAB.
But it is not an iterative solver.
No. Okay. Yeah, we're comparing direct to direct. Yeah, and the accuracy that we set for the tolerance was, I think, like 8 digits. So it was very high accuracy, more than the you would want at that level of discretization. Okay, so the question, so that was just to say that maybe this is worth doing. Okay, so now the question is, how do we construct a fast solver for just the FMM part, so not the sparse matrix stuff, just the FMM part. So the key thing is just to write down the FMM recursions, and then you get a fast solver. That's my, I guess, the main theme of this talk. So what is the FMM recursion? The idea is that you just try to multiply this matrix into a vector, and wherever you see some calculation, see whether you can repeat the calculation again, and if you can repeat the calculation again, you save it. Okay, so this is called the state space method by systems theory. So let's look at it. So if you know at some point this submatrix must multiply this sub-block of the vector you're multiplying into, you have to multiply those two together. This submatrix has a representation U, V, V, and you have to multiply into X. So at some point you have to multiply this V into X. It has to be done. Right? And not only that, this V into X will also be done for this block and for the block over here. So the calculation must be repeated again and again. So you give it a name and you save it. It's usually I give it an NG. Okay, V times X is called G. So that is going to be one of our state variables. Okay, something which we must keep track of, the V's times the X's at multiple levels of closeness. Okay? So now what happens? We don't have a particular V, right? Remember, we don't have the V's at the coarse level. So in the previous case, we don't have the V for this block right now. We have a V, the row basis for this block, but not the row basis for that block. So we have to have a scheme for computing G without the V with us. And obviously the way to do that is to observe that you could have reconstructed the basis at the coarser level from the row basis at the final level using the translation operators. Therefore, this V times X can be written as this times you split the X in half, XL and XR, and multiply those out. XL times VL gives me GL, and VR times that gives me the G at the lower levels. So you see that if I have the G's from the final level, I can use the translation operators to construct a G at the coarser level. Okay, so this is the first observation by Vladimir that we could assemble these V times X's starting at the finest level and then working our way up through the tree, constructing them at the coarser level, and these are called upstream recursions. And the key thing is to observe that this is a linear recursion. So G is unknown, this G is unknown, this G is unknown. If you multiply, if you're trying to invert the problem, and only the W's, which are the translation operators, are unknown. Okay, usually this FMM upstream recursion, I would display on a graph, and this graph is going to be our sparse matrix representation. So we construct the graph as we go along in the talk. Okay, so here's the vector X, which is coming in. So this is from the systems theory guide, how they draw. This is slightly different from the way sparse matrix people do it. Okay, so the signal X is split up into four pieces, and it's sent into four different nodes. Each node corresponds, so if you come over here, I'm taking my input X, chopping it up. One X goes down this way, one X comes down that way, one X comes down this way, one X comes down that way. Okay, so that's why it's called input signals in systems theory. So the same thing over here, the incoming X, I laid it down this way, now I chopped it up. Each X is here, it gets multiplied by the corresponding row basis for that block column. It forms the corresponding G at the finest level. Then you use the translation operators to merge these two G's to give me a G at the coarser levels. You keep going up until you reach the root. Okay, so that is the signal flow graph for the thing. Okay, now once we form V times X, so we're going back to multiplication. Now we're already forming V times X. I have to multiply that V times X into B and then into a U and then add it to the output over there. Right? Just for that block. Then other blocks will contribute the addition, which will then finally get added up over there. again, we have b, and we have b times x now, because that's just g, which we computed. So b times d can be followed through. But u times this thing cannot be done, because we don't have u at this level. OK, so we don't have u, but we do have u in terms of the use of the final levels to the translation operators. So what I do is I call b times g as f. I need to multiply f into u. I cannot do that, so I multiply f into this piece instead. So I multiply f into this, and f into this. And I send it down. So this f is coming out, is split in two parts. One is in down this part, and one is in down this one. So that's the output flow. OK, and it'll pick up the smaller guy as it goes to the output. So you start from the top of the tree, and you trickle down all the way to the bottom, collecting your f's as you go. And finally, at the root level, at the leaf level, you will have the u's ready to go out. Okay, so here's the full version of the pickup that we're going to do. So all of these blocks are going to contribute their b times v times x to this output over here, right? And the v times x's I call the g's. They get multiplied by the b's. Since they all have a common u, the u can be factored out, and you can just sum the b times g's as they're coming through. But there are also inputs coming from these coarser blocks, so that's what I was called the star part over there, and they're going to come in from the top. Okay, so this part, which is coming in from the coarser block, will be the f at this level multiplied by the translation operator at that level that you have to add. Okay, so this is the final downsweep recursion. It tells you how to find an f at any level, from the f's at the previous level, the g's at the same level, and the b's at the same level. Okay, and again, the key thing is that this is a linear recursion in f and g, and it's short. The number of b's you will see in this term is proportional to the number of blocks at that level, and only one r from the previous level. Okay, the same thing for the bottom row, like this, again. You pick up the b's from that level. The f from here would multiply by the lower level translation operator, and it comes out over there. Okay, so that it splits as it goes down. Okay, so here's the final FMM downsweep recursions. The f from the parent gets split two ways, one to the left translation operator, one to the right translation operator. It picks up the b's and g's at each level and goes down to the f's at the, for the children. When you finally hit the leaf, you actually have the u, so you multiply the u into f, and then you pick up any dense matrices which have been left unaccounted for. So any dense sub-blocks inside have no representation, so you just multiply them with the corresponding inputs, sum it up into the output. Okay, so those are the final downsweep recursions, and it terminates at the leaf. So if you write down, if you combine all of the graphs together, this is what we have. Here's the input x coming in. So if you follow, say, into the first block column, the input at the first block column gets multiplied by a v, forms this g, and it is used with the translation operators to form g's, and it goes up. Once you get the g, you start with an empty f. This f has nothing in it, because there's no u higher than this coefficient level. Take this f, which initialized to be empty, multiply by the translation operators, find the f at the lower parts, push them down, and when they come down, they pick up the b's coming in from the sides like that, to these edges. So this g, for example, gets multiplied by b, and goes to that output. This this g gets multiplied by this b and goes to this output, and so on. Okay? And the FMM, the edges tell you which way to go down. When you finally hit the leaf, the b, you have an f coming in, multiply u and add, and any other dense sub-blocks which you are left accounting for only lie at this level. So we assume that the dense matrix only work at the finest level, or we just chop them up. So the d's only lie, and you finally have the final signal flow graph. Okay, so things flow up, and they flow down, exchanging information sideways, they come all the way to the bottom. Okay, so that's the system state representation. We think of these intermediate inner variables, f and g, as state variables. Okay, so that's the FMM graph, and this is exactly the graph which represents the fast solver too. Okay, so the basic idea is, so these set of recursions over here, so this recursion, so now we are not multiplying the matrix into the vector x. So now we have an FMM matrix with some structure over here, multiplying into this vector x to get a b. So the FMM assumes x is given and multiplying to form b. Now we are saying that x is unknown B is known, the afternoon structure is known. So how do I quickly find X is the question. Okay, so now since we don't know X, we don't know any of the G's. Okay, so G's become unknown. So this G is unknown, this G is unknown, this G is unknown. But the equation connecting these G's is linear and short. In this case, it's only a three-term, it's only three unknowns. Okay, so those are the upsweep recursions. They're clearly sparse. Right? Only three variables in every equation, three block variables. Okay. So the downsweep recursions look like this. Since I don't know G's, I obviously don't know the F's either. So this is an unknown. All the G's here are unknowns. This F is an unknown. But again, the number of G's which occur in this term is only proportional to the number of blocks at that level. So it's a few of them, typically. And then this F and that F. So these are all sparse. Similarly, this is also filled up unknown. The X's are unknowns and the F's are unknown. The B, of course, is not. Okay, so this is sparse. It's a system of sparse equations. It's with very little effort. You can show that the corresponding, if you, you know, write on all the sparse equations, they are invertible. The condition number is good, so you don't introduce any artificial ill conditioning into the equations, so nothing goes bad numerically. And you can show that there are many orderings of the sparse equation. Okay, in one particular ordering, the FMM will be the sure complement of a submatrix of the sparse matrix. So the FMM can be written out in as one line, as you know, some matrix times some inverse times some matrix times some inverse and so on. And that representation is called a diagonal representation and is used by systems theorists as a way to generalize all the rational function stuff we do with time invariant systems. Okay, and there's a whole bunch of stuff. You can go that way. I'll talk about it a little bit if I get some time later on. But the key thing is that if you look at these sparse equations, then there's another order in which Gaussian elimination can proceed rapidly. So now this is my system of equations. This is graph representing a sparse system of equations. The B's are the known quantities. The X's, G's, and F's are unknowns in the sparse matrix. So clearly sparse, right? So the connection between the variables is very sparse over there. So I can solve these equations by any sparse solver. Just MATLAB is good enough. Okay, so my student has used it to solve like the integral equation by Helmholtz using MATLAB is deadly fast. Okay, so so there is an ordering, and you can see there's an ordering because it's a tree-like structure. Okay. For example, you have to solve, you know, you could use a nested dissection ordering on this tree now. So for example, you'll solve for this and this. So you'll solve all of these variables first, you'll eliminate all of these variables first, and then you'll eliminate all of these variables, and then recursively like that. That's the nested dissection ordering of this tree. A simple analysis will show later on, I won't want to do this, but a simple analysis shows that because that those have certain kind of separators, that if we do a sparse solver on this, then the continuity of the graph is determined only by the dimension D from which the problem arose. And the fill-in will be controlled by this D, and therefore this will be the estimate for the solver. Okay, so it's very simple and it works. And the only thing you have to remember is that the graph must be ordered in this nested dissection ordering. There might be better ordering. So actually what we did was we didn't order the graph in the nested dissection ordering. We took the FMM representation, and we let MATLAB's ordering algorithms pick their own ordering. And typically they did better than nested dissection. So there's column in degree and all kind of funny orderings you can try. And any one of them was reasonably good. Numerical issues were not a problem in the things that we looked at, because you can show that there is a QR factorization which will give of the sparse matrix will give you that kind of complexity too. So it's not going to be an issue. But typically QR is kind of slow because it fills in quite heavily, and LU with some kind of minimal pivoting is mostly good enough, especially if you know your matrix is nicely diagonally dominant. Okay, however, this kind of a complexity is not good if you have an integral equation which fills out a volume in 3D, then this is dead in the water. Okay, this solver is impossibly slow. Even though it's n squared, you know, you would think, okay, n squared, right? It's not even a big polynomial. It's no good for at least for engineers to use. So the questions that you know, that people have been trying to look at is that, so this, notice that this complexity is irrespective of whether the inverse is oscillating or not. If the inverse of the FMM matrix has lots of oscillations in it, it doesn't matter. You will still get this amount of complexity. So if you're solving eigenfunction of Laplacians, you will still get that complexity. Okay, so this kind of improvement in complexity already helps find element and finite difference method. It doesn't help integral equation method, but it helps finite difference and finite element methods. So for example, if you're doing a finite difference of finite element methods in 3D, then you would expect that the solver would have complexity, a direct solver would have complexity n squared flops for n is the number of unknowns. However, because the separators in the 3D case are two-dimensional, the solver that you need to use, the integral equation solver you need to use for the separators, is only a 2D solver, and that will run much faster at n to the power 1.5 flops. Okay, so for sparse finite element and finite difference methods, just this solver, if you couple it correctly with the sparse solver, will already give you an order of magnitude speedup. It won't make it linear, but it'll already be much faster. Okay, so the question is whether, if we can reduce the timing of the FMM solvers even further, then of course integral equation solvers will be faster, but as an added bonus, we'll get that also PDE solvers will be even faster. Okay? So the timing I showed was coupling the integral equation solver with the PDE solver in a two-dimensional case, and we showed that essentially you get almost to linear sense. So the question there was, if I couple the integral equation solver with a PDE solver in 2D, can I actually make it linear? So right now, if I don't couple it, the complexity is O of n to the power 1.5. And the question is whether if you couple it, would you get it all the way down to O of n or not? That is it worth trying to push these solvers past this? Okay, so this part, we did some experiments and we found, oh yeah, it does seem to push it. But the question is whether does it actually do it or not, theoretically. Okay, so there are lots of papers which are saying that, you know, it should do it, and you know, here are the conjectures, and you know, it's very hard, at least for me to sort out and say whether it is, or how far the proofs actually go. So, in the last part of my talk, I have a few more minutes left, I will try to present a very, very simple analysis, okay, of this question in the model 2D problem case, saying that yes, we can push it all the way to a linear time solver. All right, so here's the model PDE, just positive net on this uniform grid. So I'm going to assume there are n points this way and m points that way, and I'm actually going to dumb it down and make P and Q constant too. Okay, I'm going to use 5-point stencil on this. If you discretize this thing using 5 points, it will log tridiagonal matrix like this, where the unknowns are ordered column-wise. So I'm going to stack the columns in very dumb order. I'm going to stack the unknowns this way. Column scan the unknowns and stack them. Okay, so it's horribly bad ordering. I want to show that even with all this badness, we'll still get a linear time algorithm. Okay, so this is how it is all stacked up. Since I'm using only 5 points, then each of these A's and the B's are also themselves tridiagonal matrices. So everything inside is tridiagonal. Okay, now we assume this matrix is positive definite, and we do Gauss elimination on this and study what's the block to the complexity. So in the first stage, I will eliminate, say, this matrix by Gauss elimination. When I do that, I will get a fill-in over here. This is a tridiagonal matrix over here. It gets A1 will get replaced by this matrix, which is a sure complement at that stage. Right? And you notice that A0 is a tridiagonal, so its inverse is a full matrix, therefore this S1 is already a full matrix. Okay, and that's why this is considered a bad order in this sparse matrix. Now, the key thing, of course, is that even though S1 is full, it is the inverse of a tridiagonal matrix is known to be semi-separable, which means that its upper triangular part comes from a rank 2 matrix, and the lower triangular part comes from another rank 2 matrix, because it's semi-separable. So it has FMM structure in spades. So test FMM structure. Now, I use this S1 to eliminate this one, and I'll get S2, which is the sure complement. So this is the inverse of that semi-separable matrix. It's not banded, unfortunately. But it is still FMM in a certain strange way. And so this will continue to be FMM, but with much higher ranks now. The ranks will be 4 and all pattern blocks. So after a while, if you keep track of this algebraically, you'll see that the ranks are full. And you don't get any benefit from maintaining this FMM structure in the elimination. So the question was that, will there be some cancellation in these things that we're adding up such that the ranks don't grow algebraically? Just from pure linear algebra, they should grow. Ranks should, the words could just keep adding up, and by the time you're quarter of the way through the minute, you're wasting your time keeping track of the structure. Right? And what we want to show is that, well, if you keep doing this, maybe some magic happens, and maybe not all of these I give it as a lining up in different direction, but they all sort of nearly parallel, so you won't get this rank addition, and the ranks will stabilize after a certain time. Okay. So here's a summary of that. So what I'm going to show is this. I'm going to say, if you look at these shear complement matrices, and you look at only this off-diagonal block, okay, I'm chop the shear complement anywhere you feel like. Take the matrix, chop it anywhere into 2x2, and look at this off-diagonal block. These in system theory, these blocks are called Henkel blocks. Okay, they touch the diagonal. So remember, that was there in the FMM to touch the diagonal, but we're going to look at those blocks because they control the complexity in the Gauss elimination. Okay, actually, I was lying a lot when I said that FMM structure should be used. It turns out that the FMM structure is actually overkill for Gauss elimination. Gauss elimination doesn't exploit all of the structure. But anyway, so this is the block which controls the structure. No finest thing matters for complexity estimates. So we're going to show that when P and Q are constant coefficient and I have some things, that no matter how far I go in the elimination, I can keep going to infinity, the numerical rank of this block will remain a constant. Okay, that's what we're going to show. Okay, so to make the problem easy to analyze, I'm going to make the grid infinite in one direction. So I'm going to have infinite number of unknowns, so the grid goes up all the way to infinity. So my matrix becomes infinitely long this way. Okay, and I'm going to assume that all the constants are all the coefficients are constant, so that my analysis becomes very, very simple. So this is why I said the analysis is very simple, because it's a very simple case. So A's and B's are constants. And I'm going to assume, and it's true for the 5-point sensor in this case, that the A, B's, C's, and A0's commute with each other. Okay, so they all commute with each other. Things become blindingly simple. Okay, so this is the recursion that we have to analyze. We want to look at the Schur complement, which is not given by this very simple recursion. And we want to ask, if I look at S infinity, what is this FMM structure? That's the question. Okay? Because here are the assumptions. You can prove that under the assumption that I made, that this matrix will be positive definite. Just a simple homework exercise, I want to rate that point. Okay, but it's critical because that matrix A squared minus 4CB, the discriminant will appear in the analysis. Because all the matrices commute with each other for the 5-point sensor case, we can pull the eigenvectors off, and we can further assume that everything inside is a diagonal matrix. Okay, so the analysis is like almost a scalar analysis now, okay? So we can't get easier than this. Okay, so we proceed now. So we want to find the fixed point of this iteration, Si to Si plus 1, okay? So this one, this iteration over here. So Si is mapped Si plus 1 by the recursion. We want to find the fixed point. First of all, is there a fixed point? And does it converge to the fixed point? All these are questions to be answered. Okay, luckily I didn't have to figure out why and how these things converge. I'm sure it's terribly easy for people who are used to this. But it turns out there's a very simple way to look at it. So complex theorists call this particular transformation a Mobius transform. So it turns out that if you look at this recursion, a much better way to write, because all these, even though these are matrices, they're diagonals which commute with each other, we don't have to worry about where we write the term. We can actually write them at the denominator like this. So you see that if I write the term like this instead, it means the same thing as this expression over here. Because they all commute, I can actually write things at the bottom, even though they're matrices. Then you see that actually the expression on the top and the expression on the bottom is linear, which suggests some kind of predictive geometry, I guess. But anyway, to a linearity just means you give this a name and you give this a name. You call this PI, you call this a QI, and you lift the iteration to a higher dimension. So rather than talking about the S's, you talk about P's and Q's separately. Okay, so for example, S0 was just A0, so P0 will be A0, Q0 will be I. And then the original recursion just becomes this linear recursion now. That's the key point. The recursion for the SIs was nonlinear, but the recursion for the P and the Q is linear with a constant iterator in front. So everything is just eigenanalysis now. Very trivial. These are all block matrices, these are all block diagonal matrices, that's for sure, but it's a scalar analysis, so you can write down the eigenvalues, the block eigenvalues of that 2x2 block matrix, and it's trivial, so you can, just one line, you can write down this is the two eigenvalues, and you notice that the square root of A squared minus 4CB arises, and I assume that was positive. Okay, so this is a nice, just positive number after the square root. The eigenvectors can be computed similarly in terms of these two matrices, chi plus and chi minus, and this is the whole eigendecomposition of the iterator matrix. Okay, so since we have the whole eigendecomposition, and since the iteration is just a power iteration, just you repeatedly apply this iteration again and again and again, you know that the convergence will be to the dominant eigenvector if you start up with an initial projection on the eigenvector, on the dominant eigenvector. So the dominant eigenvector in this case is chi plus, because this eigenvector is larger than this, because this is a positive way along. So since we have, since pi and qi have a non-zero projection on a0i, which is the starting point, we know we're going to converge to the dominant eigenvector, which is this one. Okay, therefore, the limit will be this p over this q, like this, and this is the limit of that iteration in the limiting case. Okay, so people have apparently guessed that this was the limit, but for some reason nobody had ever proved it, even though it seems utterly trivial now. Anyway, it's a simple thing. So this is the limit of the Schur complement. So we just have to prove that this matrix has FMM structure, which is much more tractable. Now, let's just look at it. What's the difficulty now? So this is the only part I'll ever use analysis in. This A is tridiagonal, or diagonal if you wish. Yeah, but in the end, we have to put the eigenvectors back in. We put the eigenvectors back in, and we see that A is tridiagonal, C is tridiagonal, B is tridiagonal. So this whole thing inside is a banded matrix, which is positive definite. I'm asking, if you take the square root of a banded matrix, will it have FMM structure or not? Okay, so the answer, a short circuit, rather than looking at it very generally, we use the theorem of Newman's, which just tells that if you take a square root function, then there's a rational function which will approximate the square root on the whole interval 0 to 1. That's the amazing part of this theorem, to this accuracy. So if you use pth order term, if you use a pth order polynomial on the numerator and a pth order polynomial on the denominator, then you can pick those polynomials, and there's a closed form expression for those rational functions, which will give you this much of accuracy. It's almost exponential. Okay, so it's very, very rapid convergence of the rational function to square root, even though we're including the singularity in the region of convergence. Okay, so now the rest of it is just blindingly simple. So since there is a rational function which approximates the square root, I can throw away the square root and put a rational function in that place. So I just need to say that if I apply a polynomial to a banded matrix, it will remain FMM. And the polynomial is a finite length. But that is obviously true because of these theorems. And these are well-known facts in linear algebra. So it just says that if I take a matrix like this, and I multiply the matrix looks like this, so this is low rank, this is low rank, this is low rank, and this is low rank, and I'll get something whose rank here is the sum of these two ranks, and the rank here is the sum of these two ranks. So if you multiply two such matrices, the rank at most adds up, but since the polynomial has only maximum degree p, you're going to like increase the rank by at most p, and then another p for the additions. Then what about when you invert it? Same thing. It is known that if this is low rank, and this is low rank, and you invert it, then this will also be low rank and low rank without any increase. So those are trivial results. So therefore, the fact it's a rational function does not bother us, and the rest is just points out. So once you have Newman's theorem, then the work is cut short immediately. So essentially, there's if you start up with A whose off diagonal blocks have low rank, then square root of A will continue to do that. And the Newman's theorem tells you how much it's going to increase. You just estimate how big P has to be chosen for a particular epsilon. And then you have some extra factor because you have A squared minus 4CB under the square root. You put all that in, and you get this as the estimate of the off diagonal rank. Okay, you can see that it only depends upon the tolerance that you want to pick and the norm of the matrix, because it will scale the rational function. It doesn't depend upon anything else. Okay, so we have this, and obviously since it's true for the last Schur complement, by some technicality it must be true for the intermediate ones, and with some more effort you can prove that too, so I won't mention that. That's just, okay. All right. Any questions?
So what is your definition of nice coefficients in the last?
I didn't know, because that's why I started with a numerical example.
Why not just any coefficient? Well, I mean, strongly in the strongly elliptic case, right? Why not? So I would conjecture there's just another logarithm in there somewhere.
Well, positive definitely needed, but you agree with that. Because if you don't have positive definite, say I take.
Yeah, but I give you positive definite. I said something stronger.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a positive definiteness.
So
I think. Yeah, I think that would be enough.
Right.
Yeah, I think, but I don't know how to prove it, so. Maybe you can.
Yeah.
Any questions?